Investiture of the Gods, Chapter 17.
And the action starts with this really dramatic confrontation, and it involves a very unique kind of fire, a spiritual fire.
Okay, so Zhang Ziya, he's kind of our protagonist here. He pulls out this Samadhi True Fire. Now, this isn't just lighting a match, is it? Tell us about this fire. It sounds intense.
Oh, it is. It is legendary in these kinds of stories. It's described as a spiritual flame. It's supposed to be refined from a person's essence, their energy, and their spirit. You know, deep cultivation stuff.
Wow.
And the text says it shoots from his eyes, nose, and mouth. So yeah, it's definitely not ordinary fire. It signifies something more, like a divine or highly cultivated power stepping in.
And the demon involved, its reaction is instant, right? Pure agony.
Absolutely. It's screaming, Zhang Ziya, I don't have any beef with you. Why are you using this fire on me? Even King Zhu, the tyrant king, is terrified. The text says he's sweating, can't even speak. He's just watching this raw magic unfold.
So what happens when the fire dies down? What's left?
Well, after all the thunder and lightning effects that go with it, it's not some, you know, charred monster. It's revealed to be this beautiful jade pipa, like a lute.
A musical instrument.
Exactly. Yeah. And that transformation is crucial. If you think about the bigger picture, this isn't just a magic show. It's the first real, tangible proof of these supernatural forces working against King Zhu's rule. It shows the true nature of the corruption around him.
And Daji. She's connected to this demon, isn't she? The source says her heart felt like a knife twisting inside. This was one of her own kind.
Yes, she's secretly devastated, but she is incredibly cunning. She doesn't show it. She immediately composes herself.
So what does she do? How does she spin this?
It's quite clever, in a really dark way. She advises King Zhu, oh, this Zhang Ziya, he's so talented, you should appoint him lower grandmaster. Make him supervisor of astronomy, like it's a big reward.
Okay.
Then she makes this seemingly innocent request. Oh, that jade pipa, can I have it? I'd love to string it and, you know, play it for you.
But that's obviously not her real plan. She doesn't want to play music.
Not a chance. Her real plan is to take that pipa, which is still a powerful demonic entity, remember, and place it on the star-picking tower.
Which is already a symbol of the king's excess.
Precisely. She wants it up there to absorb the spiritual energy of heaven and earth, the essence of the sun and moon. Mm. The idea is that it needs 5 years up there to regain its original demonic form.
5 years, that's patient.
Incredibly patient. It shows her long game. This is all about ensuring the Shang dynasty falls completely. And it really makes you wonder, doesn't it, how much of this whole disaster is Daji's direct manipulation, and how much is King Zhu just easily led, or even actively participating in his own downfall.
Meanwhile, Jiang Ziya, he has no idea about this, right? He accepts the job titles, celebrates a bit, and heads back to court. He's basically walking right into her trap.
Completely unaware.
So I guess the takeaway here is pretty stark. Deception can be incredibly patient, hiding behind smiles and praise, all while planning something, you know, devastating down the line. It's a chilling look at manipulation.
Absolutely. A masterclass in it.
Okay, so let's jump forward those 5 years. King Zhu and Daji are up on that scar-picking tower, having a good time. Daji's performing, everyone's cheering, except for a group of palace women, about 70 of them. They're silent and they're crying.
Mm-hmm. And this is where things get really, really dark.
Why are they crying?
Well, someone looks into it, and it turns out these women used to serve the previous empress, Empress Zhang, who, you might remember, was framed for treason and executed largely thanks to Daji.
Ah, okay, so their grief is genuine.
It is, but Daji sees their sadness, their silence, as a threat. She calls it a danger to the palace, and she uses this passive show of loyalty to the dead queen to justify something truly horrific.
And this is where the Chai Pen comes in, the scorpion pit.
Exactly. She proposes this idea to King Zhu. Let's dig a massive pit, she gives dimensions, 24 zhang wide, that's huge, like 80 meters across, mm-hmm. and 5 zhang deep, maybe 16 meters.
Okay. And then what?
Fill it. Fill it with poisonous snakes, then take these 70-odd women, strip them naked, and just throw them in as food for the snakes.
Just thrown in as food. How does King Zhu even respond to that? Is there any hesitation?
Yeah.
Any revulsion?
None. Zero. This moment really shows that his moral compass isn't just broken, it's gone. He actually praises Daji, calls it an ingenious method.
Ingenious.
Yes, an ingenious way to remove great evils from the palace. It's just staggering. It's moved beyond punishment into pure dehumanizing spectacle. It shows how easily a leader stripped of morality becomes a tool for extreme cruelty. Daji suggests it, he enables it.
And then he makes it official. Issues a decree.
A truly insane one. Every single household in the capital city has to provide 4 snakes. 4.
What does that even do to the city?
Chaos. absolute chaos. People are desperate. They're traveling hundreds of miles just to buy snakes to meet the quota. Normal life just stops. And resentment. You can feel it boiling under the surface. Any loyalty people might have had left for the king is just evaporating.
It really shows how quickly things can fall apart, how targeted cruelty just spills out and affects everyone.
It's exactly. Destabilizes the whole society.
Okay, so amidst all this madness, we meet Zhao Gi. He's a high grandmaster working in the records office. How does he first become aware of this horror?
Well, he's observant. He starts noticing ordinary folks coming into the palace carrying baskets, baskets full of snakes. He sees groups of three or four people all bringing snakes.
And he doesn't just let it go.
No, he's methodical. He starts asking questions. He talks to other high officials, big names like Huang Feihu, the military commander, Bigin, the wise advisor, Weizi and Jizi, other respected figures. Some are worried like him. Others seem completely clueless.
So it seems like even at the top, information isn't flowing. Or people are choosing not to know.
It definitely raises that question, doesn't it? The complicity of silence or just ignorance in a regime like this? What's the responsibility of these officials? Anyway, Zhao Ge sends one of his own men to find out exactly why all these snakes are being collected.
So the snakes are gathered over, what, 5 or 7 days? The pit is ready. Da Ji signals the king.
And they bring out the women.
They do, the 72 women. They're bound, stripped naked. The text uses the term T, which is quite stark, and dragged to the edge of this massive pit teeming with vipers.
Oh, God.
And it's at this point Zhao Gi finally gets the full picture. He hears their screams, agonized screams echoing through the palace, and his investigator returns with the awful truth.
So he goes from seeing snakes to hearing the direct result.
Exactly. It clicks. The abstract knowledge becomes this visceral, undeniable horror. He understands what the Chai Pen really is.
And he acts immediately, instantly. He doesn't hesitate. He runs straight for the star-picking tower, where the king and Da Ji are watching this unfold. He's shouting, "He's our villa! How can this be done?"
He just bursts in.
Bursts in, confronts the king directly, interrupting their sadistic pleasure. I mean, you have to imagine the courage that took. Standing up to absolute power like that, knowing the likely cost, it's an incredible moment of defiance.
King Zhu must have been furious being interrupted like that.
Livid. Absolutely livid, but Zhao Ge doesn't back down. He's weeping, but he lays out his case. He tells the king straight, these cruel and barbaric punishments, they're destroying the kingdom.
He spells it out for him.
He does. He says the people are suffering, the bond between ruler and ministers is broken, society itself is collapsing. He uses this phrase, jifonya, like the whole universe is blocked up, dysfunctional, it's powerful stuff.
What specific points does he make? What's his argument against this?
Well, it's a really strong ethical argument. First, he says these palace women are basically innocent, or at least their perceived offense is minor. There's absolutely no precedent for cruelty like this. He appeals to the king's sense of, well, basic decency, invoking heaven's fundamental virtue of cherishing life.
A core principle, right?
A core principle of legitimate rule. Then he reminds the king about the relationship between ruler and ministers. The ruler's the head, the ministers are the limbs. You're cutting off your own arms and legs, basically.
He doesn't hold back.
Not at all. He lists the king's other atrocities. Killing the eastern and southern marquises unjustly. Executing officials who dared to speak out using that horrific punishment, the burning pillar. And now this, the snake pit for innocent women.
Wow.
He calls out the king's indulgence, listening to slander, meaning dodgy, his debauchery, his drinking. He calls it all a fatal sickness in the king's heart.
He's basically delivering a diagnosis of tyranny.
Exactly. And he warns him. The kingdom built by your ancestors, he names their virtues. Diligence, frugality, respecting heaven, fearing the people.
Well, it's all at risk. The ancestral altars, the Yeriju, the very legitimacy of the dynasty won't be yours much longer if you continue like this. It's an incredibly brave and direct condemnation.
How does King Zhu take this lecture, essentially?
Predictably badly. He dismisses Zhao Ge's points as just reason, implies harshness is needed. Then he just snaps, pure rage, calls Zhao Ge a ho-ho, which sounds odd, like good rascal, but it's meant as a real insult, like impudent fool. And then he gives the order, strip him naked, throw him into the Chai Pen.
No, he orders his own high grandmaster into the snake pit.
He does. But Zhao Ge gets the last word, in a way.
What does he do?
He shouts back, defiant to the end, calls King Zue to the knighted virtuous tyrant. He curses him, says this brutality will absolutely mean the end of the Shang Dynasty. He even brings up the prophecy about the Western Marquis rising, basically saying, your replacement is coming. And then, does he let them throw him in?
No, he makes his own choice. Rather than face that horrific death, that utter degradation in the pit, he leaps. He jumps from the star-picking tower.
He chooses his own end.
He does. The text is graphic. The text is graphic. He crashed down, brains spilled, dying violently, unnaturally. It's a tragic but incredibly powerful final act of protest.
Wow. What a story. The poem at the end of the chapter, does it honor him?
It does. It praises his red-blooded loyalty, his deep concern for the nation. It acknowledges the tragedy, but frames his death as noble, a sacrifice driven by integrity. His death, while awful, becomes this symbol, doesn't it? That valuing truth and justice can mean paying the ultimate price, but that spirit endures. You'd expect maybe shock, remorse from the king.
You would hope so.
But no. King Zhu's reaction is just pure, unadulterated rage, furious that his authority was challenged.
And that reaction is so telling. It's not just anger about the death, it's anger about the descent. Huh? He sees it as a rejection of him.
Yeah.
His response shows this total rejection of any counsel, any moral boundary. He doesn't just punish Zhao Ge posthumously. He, like, invents this new horrific form of cruelty.
The Chai Pen.
Exactly. He orders Zhao Ge's remains, and get this, 72 palace women thrown into this Chai Pen. Maybe witnesses, maybe just collateral damage to make the point. It's about demonstrating absolute, terrifying control, erasing dissent, making an example. And the source describes the palace women, totally innocent, crying out, asking why they face such a, it's, you know, cruel punishment for doing nothing wrong.
Just bystanders, caught in his rage.
Exactly. And their last words are these curses against Daji, wishing they could eat her flesh or her spirit. It's just this raw cry against the injustice of it all.
And the king and Daji, how do they react watching this unfold? I can barely imagine.
King Zhu just watches as starving snakes coil around the palace women, swallowing and biting their skin, drilling into their abdomens. The text uses the term day, immense, unbearable pain.
He just watches.
Watches. And Daji, her response is chillingly calm. She just coolly says, if not for this punishment, how could we eliminate the great troubles in the palace?
Troubles? What troubles? They didn't do anything.
In her twisted logic, their mere existence, perhaps associated with the old guard or just inconvenient, is the trouble. Brutality becomes order.
Wow.
And Qin Zhu, completely captivated, strokes her back, praises her marvelous and unique method.
The method. It's torture.
It's this incredibly perverse scene. Torture as statecraft. It shows how far gone he is, how deep her influence runs. The normalization of it is maybe the most terrifying part.
That's a really sharp point. It's not just one cruel act. It's like a whole system of depravity being set up, with Daji pulling the strings. The chapter even has a poem about it, right? What does that add?
Yeah, the poem acts like this stark summary. It paints this vivid image. Scorpion pit, snakes and scorpions ferocious, and how the palace women suffer in this pit, pitifully dying worse than being boiled in oil.
Worse than being boiled in oil? That's intense.
It really is. That phrase invokes this traditional image of extreme suffering, like a punishment from hell in Chinese folklore. It signals right away that Zhu's reign has entered this infernal realm. Sets a grim tone. It's a cosmic wrong, not just a human tragedy.
So from the horrors of the scorpion pit, King Zhu somehow finds inspiration. His fascination with cruelty just grows, and Daji is right there to channel it into her next, well, equally grotesque masterpiece.
She really is a twisted visionary, isn't she? But there's a calculated purpose behind it all.
What do you mean?
Well, thinking bigger picture, Daji isn't just trying to entertain the king or indulge herself. She's systematically cutting him off from reality. By surrounding him with this extreme sensory overload pleasure on one hand, extreme cruelty on the other, she severs his connection to, you know, actual governance, to empathy, even common sense. She's creating this echo chamber of depravity.
An environment where only her ideas make sense to him.
Exactly. He becomes utterly dependent on her for entertainment, for solutions. He's trapped in the world she builds around him.
And what are these next grotesque creations? The source mentions a meat forest and a wine lake.
Yeah, pretty unique, right? She proposes these two, well, architectural slash culinary features. On one side, a kukana, Literally a hill made of fermented grains.
Fermented grains? Like mash?
Yeah, brewer's grains or something similar. And into this hill, they stick branches and drape them with thin slices of meat, forming the meat forest.
Okay. Bassar. And the other side?
A massive pool filled with wine. The wine lake.
Just a lake of wine.
And she sells it to Zhu as fitting for an emperor's unlimited wealth. He, of course, thinks it's exotic, unique, and truly enjoyable.
It's just unimaginable excess. A total perversion of abundance.
What's the deeper agenda there?
Well, it's not just showing off. It's corrupting the very idea of abundance, isn't it?
Yeah, it feels wrong.
Exactly.
The meat forest and wine lake become these symbols of his reign. An empire literally drowning in its own excessive, decaying indulgence, built on fermenting rot. It's an environment designed to just obliterate any thought beyond immediate gratification. He's a prisoner of senses, blind to everything else.
So they have these new, elaborate, frankly disgusting backdrops. What's the entertainment? Dodgy finds the music boring, apparently.
Right. And this is where it gets even more horrifying, if that's possible.
What new game does she propose?
She suggests wrestling matches.
Wow.
Between palace women and eunuchs.
Okay. Humiliating, but...
But the stakes. The winners get rewarded with wine from the lake. Standard enough, maybe. But the losers, they're deemed useless maids. They're killed, executed with a golden mace to the head. And then, horrifyingly, their bodies are thrown into the fermented grain heap of the meat forest.
Thrown into the grain? Why? Just disposal.
Not just disposal. This is where the text reveals Dodgy's darkest secret. The reason for this specific gruesome method.
Okay. I'm bracing myself.
Dodgy, in her true form, remember, she's not human.
Right, the fox spirit.
Exactly. She would emerge late at night, two or three watches, the text says, very specific, middle of the night.
Yeah.
And eat the palace people from the fermented grains.
Eat them?
Yes. To nourish her Elysian, her demonic energy. To maintain her power, her illusion, her hold over King Zhou.
That's... Wow, okay, that's the horrifying truth then. She's not just manipulating him. She's literally feeding on the victims her schemes create.
Precisely. This is the crucial aha moment. It's not just a metaphor. Her power, her ability to maintain this facade, literally comes from consuming the life force of the kingdom, funneled through these victims. It symbolizes how the entire court, under Zhu, is devouring its own people.
Turning human lives into fuel for its own grotesque machinery.
Perfectly put. It makes the corruption tangible, monstrous. It's a literal draining of life, a terrifying symbol of tyranny consuming itself.
And people are noticing this, right? Even the heavens. There's another poem mentioned.
Indeed. The poem highlights the growing discontent, the sense that things are deeply wrong. It says King Zhu's actions are without day, without the proper way, without moral principle.
And compares him to something.
Yes, to a mythical beast called a Kyong Chi.
A Trung Chi. What's that?
Not just any monster. In mythology, the Kyong Chi is associated with chaos, destruction, devouring people, often specifically described as eating them starting from the head.
Chillingly appropriate.
It's a perfect literary mirror for Zhu's descent into this ravenous, monstrous state. And the poem adds that the resentment from the scorpion pit pierces the sky.
So it's reaching cosmic levels.
Exactly. It signals this profound imbalance. Heaven is taking note. Impending doom is hanging over the kingdom. Such corruption simply cannot stand.
So as King Zhu sinks deeper into this arbitrary indulgence, as the text calls it.
Yeah, just random cruelty and excess.
Dodgy's schemes become more targeted. It seems even fox demons hold grudges. She remembers some old score, maybe related to the Jade Pipa spirit.
Yes, the text hints at that earlier conflict. It's like this personal vendetta resurfaces.
And this spurs her to devise a new plot aimed right at a really key figure, known to many as Jiang Ziya.
This is a critical moment.
Mm.
Because why Jiang Shang? The source suggests he's a direct and maybe uniquely powerful adversary to her demonic nature.
Someone she can't just dismiss.
Right. So her new plan is to manipulate Zhu into building the Moku, the deer terrace. She realizes some threats need a more, let's say, subtle approach than just snakes and scorpions.
Yeah.
Jian Shang's wisdom, his abilities, they make him a danger she has to neutralize carefully.
Okay, so the deer terrace. Dodgy presents the plans to King Zhu. It sounds like quite a structure.
Oh, absolutely. It's designed to be awe-inspiring, a spectacle of unbelievable luxury. The text says that's roughly 49 feet high.
Pretty tall for the time.
Definitely. Adorned with Uxi, jade palaces, Yixi, agate railings, and get this, Yiqi, pearl-adorned beams that would actually glow at night.
Wow, pearls that glow. Sounds magical. Designed to seduce, right?
Totally. Dazzle and overwhelm the senses.
And what's Dodgy's sales pitch for this incredibly expensive project? How does she hook King Z this time?
Her pitch is brilliant, really. Deeply manipulative. A masterclass in playing on his ego and his deepest fears and desires.
Go on.
She claims this terrace will be a place where a wood tool, immortals, and fairy maidens will literally descend from the heavens.
Okay, appealing to his vanity.
And more. She says this will allow King Z to extend his life and enjoy endless fortune. Immortality, basically.
The ultimate prize for a tyrant.
Exactly. And crucially, she adds that he'll share this blessing, with her. She positions herself as his indispensable partner, his link to eternal glory. How could he refuse?
Yeah, irresistible for someone like him. So then comes the twist. King Zhu asks, who could possibly supervise such a huge, complex project, the Peen?
Right. It needs someone skilled.
And Dodgy, with what sounds like fake praise, suggests Jung Shang.
Perfectly setting the trap.
She cites his amazing skill, intelligence, deep grasp of yin-yang, and knowledge of elemental cycles. Why those specific skills? Why do they make him both perfect for the job and a target for her?
Well, those skills aren't just about building things. Deep understanding of yin-yang, that's about the fundamental cosmic forces. Knowledge of elemental cycles, the five elements, crucial for everything from strategy to predicting fortunes.
So it's not just practical, it's cosmic knowledge.
Precisely. It's a level of insight that Dodgy recognizes as a threat. Someone like that might see through her illusions, sense the moral rot, maybe even warn the king or counteract her demonic power.
So appointing him puts him in a bind.
A classic lose-lose. Either he builds her monument to corruption, compromising himself, or he refuses and faces the king's wrath, fueled by her whispers.
But as you said, Zhang Sheng is no fool. When he's summoned, he immediately does what?
He performs divination, consults the unseen, taps into his wisdom.
And what does he foresee?
He immediately sees today's danger. The divination is crystal clear. Harm, no benefit. Misfortune, no good luck.
Not just a bad feeling, but a direct warning.
Exactly. It highlights his connection to that deeper reality. He sees right through the royal decree to the trap underneath. He knows taking this job isn't just morally wrong, it's dangerous.
We then get this really poignant moment with Baling, another loyal minister, right?
Yes, a touching scene. Zhang Sheng thanks Bi Gan for his mentorship, his kindness over the years.
And leaves him something.
Yes, he reveals a hidden wa, a letter, tucked under the inkstone in his study. He tells Bi Gan, if you ever face Tashifel, like great danger with absolutely no way out, read this letter.
It's his way of repaying Bi Gan's kindness, a sort of insurance policy.
Exactly. Even as he's planning his own escape, he's thinking of how to help others. Bi Gan offers to intervene, to speak to the king for him, but Zhang Sheng refuses.
Why?
He just stoically says, where my fate is sealed. Or the situation is already determined.
Acceptance of destiny.
Yes, but maybe more than just passive acceptance. That letter shows foresight. He's not just planning his own escape. He's laying groundwork. It suggests he knows his path isn't saving King Ziyu directly, but preserving something bigger.
Loyalty to the kingdom, maybe, not the king.
I think that's a great way to put it. Loyalty to the moral order itself.
So his mind's made up. He goes to the Zeising Tower, which sounds like quite a place, maybe an observatory.
Yeah, historical accounts suggest a grand multi-story building, a place for contemplation, perhaps.
And he looks at the Deer Terrace plans, what's going through his head. His internal monologue is quite revealing.
Incredibly revealing. He thinks, Chow Chow at the capital is not a place for me to stay long. His path lies elsewhere.
So he plans his exit strategy.
Yes, a very specific one. He decides to, some quotes, use words to try and awaken this deluded ruler.
Does he think it will work?
No. He fully expects the king will surely not listen and will just get angry.
So why do it?
Because that predictable anger is his escape route. The king's fury will give him the justification, the opportunity to escape and go into hiding.
Ah, clever. He's not just running away.
Not at all. He's orchestrating a principal departure, using a final symbolic act of protest telling the truth, however futile as his exit ticket. He refuses to be complicit, preserves his integrity, and crucially prepares for his much bigger role later on.
The role in eventually overthrowing Zhu.
Exactly. His departure really signals the beginning of the end for the Shang Dynasty.